So thank you very much for having me and for everyone in the audience for sticking around for the last talk. You'll be happy to hear that this will not be a very technically involved, heavy talk. I'm going to be talking about some very basic, straightforward issues, but that I think still have some very interesting, possible conceptual and mathematical and physical implications. So the title you see up here is slightly different from the title that was in the abstract, because I wanted to talk more about the relationship of these ideas to definite causal structures. But I realized that in 15 minutes, I had to give some background. So I'm only going to get to the indefinite causal structures at the very end. Oops. So I've never worked on the measurement problem before. It always struck me as too hard. None of the extant interpretations of quantum mechanics suffices, to my mind, to deal with it. Indeed, I've tried my hardest to avoid anything to do with quantum mechanics my entire career. I don't feel like we understand enough to really tackle it. In my gut, I feel that there's something about the idea of interaction, which by that I mean a superset of measurement, that we're just getting fundamentally wrong, in the same way that simultaneity was not well understood before Einstein. Unfortunately, my work in the past several years on black hole thermodynamics and semi-classical gravity has really made me, has dragged me kicking and screaming to deal with these issues. So I've started to think about them. And I'm going to tell you some of the things that I've come up with. So I'm going to draw out and make precise some differences in the mathematical representations of interaction and evolution in classical mechanics and quantum mechanics, and begin to draw some conceptual lessons from that analysis. I will not propose a solution to the measurement problem, rather a different way of looking at it, trying to approach it, and attempt to reconceptualize what a good answer to it might look like. Just to sum up where I'm going, in classical mechanics, I mean Newtonian, flat-footed, straightforward Lagrangian mechanics, classical mechanics characterizes interaction and evolution as naturally distinguished mathematically, physically, and conceptually from each other by the structure of the dynamics alone. And so the distinction and characterization of interaction and evolution is intrinsic, in fact, to the structure of the dynamics. I'll make that claim precise in a moment. There's a natural distinction, correlatively, between what it means to be a configuration quantity and what it means to be a momentum quantity. It follows that there's a natural characterization of free evolution, of isolation. And then it turns out, somewhat surprisingly, at least to me, that all of this structure that one gets from the dynamics alone, the intrinsic structure of the dynamics, actually allows one to reconstruct the entirety of classical space-time geometry. So there really is an a priori intrinsic relation between the structure of the dynamics and the background classical space-time geometry structure. And all of this has as an upshot, again, in a sense I'll make precise, that there's a clean separation of a system's degrees of freedom in classical physics from those of its environment. And to the contrary, in quantum mechanics, the conclusions will be there's no natural distinction between interaction and evolution that's intrinsic to the dynamics. There's no natural distinction between configuration and momentum quantities. There's no natural characterization of free evolution. And there is no construction of and no intrinsic a priori relation between the dynamics and space-time geometry. And there is no clean separation of a system's degrees of freedom from the environments. So to begin, very roughly, what I mean by a classical system is it's represented by states that live in a state that live in an even dimensional manifold. Its evolution is governed by Newton's second law. And by that, I mean that there's a certain algebraic structure that accrues to the family of dynamical vector fields. A dynamical vector field is a vector field on the space of states that represents the evolution of the system. I'll tell you what the algebraic structure is in a moment that captures the idea of obeying Newton's second law. There's a natural idea of interaction, applying an external force to the system. That's also represented by a vector field on the space of states. It's a vector field such that when you add it to one evolution, it moves you to the other evolution that is represented as experiencing that interaction. And there's a distinguished notion of free evolution. And so to make this idea vivid and to motivate the definitions coming up, think about Newton's second law for free particles written in perhaps a somewhat unusual but quite explicit form as two ordinary coupled differential equations, x dot equals v dot equals zero. That's completely equivalent, of course, to x double dot equals zero. The dynamical vector field that represents that evolution in these natural coordinates has its components v0. If I turn an interaction on, I hit the particle of the stick, the components of the dynamical vector field, the dynamical vector field itself changes, and the components change. Well, the x dot components don't change. The x dot components are always v. But the v dot components change to f stick in this case. And that's the case with every possible interaction I can turn on. The first components don't change, only the v dot components change. And the interaction vector field components then have the form zero f stick. So a little more precisely, a classical system is fully characterized by a space of states as an even dimensional manifold, a family of interaction vector fields that has the structure of a vector space. I can hit the particle with I can hit the particle with a stick as strong as I want in any direction I want. I can hit it with two sticks at once. All that's linearly. The family of dynamical vector fields has the structure of an affine space modeled on the vector space of interaction vector fields. If I take two evolutions and subtract them from each other, I always get an interaction vector field. In fact, the interaction that moves me from one evolution to the other. So conceptually, the family of possible interactions allows one to distinguish configuration from velocity quantities in a principled way. I don't have to tell you beforehand what is configuration and what's velocity. If I just give you these two families of vector fields with their canonical algebraic structures, I can use that to reconstruct what are the configuration quantities and what are the velocity-like quantities. Interactions directly modify the system's evolution only in velocitable directions. They're generalized accelerations. Correlatively, the physical meaning of configuration is that those quantities encode the possible interactions the system can have in this environment. Interactions are always those that don't change the configuration directly. Velocity quantities are always dynamical derivatives of configuration ones, and I mean a derivative in the sense of a derivation, mathematical derivation on the affine structure on the family of dynamical vector fields. So in particular, velocity quantities and configuration quantities stand in an asymmetric relationship to each other. One is a dynamical derivative of the other. And the free dynamical vector field, you get that for free. It's distinguished by the fact that it's the unique vector field on the space of states in which only configurative quantities change. And one can make all this precise and rigorous, both for finite dimensional systems and somewhat remarkably for fields with infinite dimensional spaces of states. So this is what I mean by classical system. There's a mathematical and conceptual distinction between configuration and velocity that's encoded in the dynamics. There's a mathematical and conceptual distinction between evolution and interaction encoded in the difference between configuration and velocity, and a naturally distinguished free evolution. There is thus always a clean separation between a system's degrees of freedom and those of its environment. No matter the interaction, I can determine the system's evolution without knowing any details whatsoever about the environment's degrees of freedom or its evolution. I treat the environment like a black box. Everything relevant is just encoded in the interaction vector field that lives on the system space of states that is formulated using the system's own quantities. It then turns out quite remarkably, I'm not going to state the theorem with any rigor or precision, I just want to give you the idea of it, that all of this machinery, all of the algebraic structure on these vector fields and these constructions actually allow you to completely recover the Euclidean geometry of ordinary space, the metrical structure of time, and the flat affine geometry of full four-dimensional Newtonian space-time. It's all completely determined by these dynamical structures. And the way it works very briefly is that in classical mechanics, evolution characterizes time. The evolution vector fields allow you to derive the affine structure of time and its geometry, while interaction, including isolation, characterizes space and its geometry. And both jointly, the way they kind of fit together, determine the full four-dimensional flat affine geometry. And so the distinction between time and space is built into the structure of the dynamics itself. The way that the dynamics hooks up to background space-time structure is rigidly enforced, as is the geometry of space-time itself. This all generalizes naturally to Lagrangian mechanics, not to Hamiltonian mechanics. I'm not gonna go through the two, these two theorems I state with some precision here, but in the interest of time, I won't actually go through them. I'll just state the consequence. If you're curious in Q&A, we can go back and look at the theorems. If I know only the space of states as an abstract manifold, and I know how to solve the Euler-Lagrange equation, I can reconstruct everything else. So I give you the space of states, I don't tell you anything else about it. The only thing I tell you is, I have a little machine such that if you give me a scalar field on the space of states, I'll crank out a vector field, which is the solution to the Euler-Lagrange equation. If that's all you know, you can recover everything. You can recover the structure of the space of states as a tangent bundle of configuration space, and you get for free the difference between configuration and velocity quantities, and correlatively, the difference between evolution and interaction, and you get it, and it uniquely determines a notion of isolation, a free evolution. In quantum mechanics, dynamical vector fields, evolutions, are just unitary flows on Hilbert space. I'm just talking about non-relativistic quantum mechanics here. Unitary flows are exponentiated Hamiltonians, you know, self-adjoint operators. The only thing interaction can be in this case is just adding another Hamiltonian. And the only fixed relation between configuration and momentum is the canonical commutation relation, in which the Q and the P enter symmetrically. If I just give you the CCR, you can't tell me what's the Q and the P. It's treated the same. More poignantly, if I give you a Hilbert space and its family of self-adjoint operators, i.e. the dynamics, you can't distinguish interactions from evolutions, external innervations such as measurements. It's just all Hamiltonians added together. You can't tell me what's configuration and what's momentum. You can't tell me what's free evolution. Like, even if I give you a standard Hamiltonian in some funky basis and ask you to decompose it into its free part and its interaction part, you won't be able to do it. What we need is an explicit representation, both of the degrees of freedom of the environment and their intertwining with those of the system, in order to appropriately and adequately treat the system during an interaction. More specifically, we need to change the space of states we use to treat the system. Now it's the tensor product of its isolated Hilbert space with that of the environment. We need to change the set of physical quantities we use. Now they come from the algebra of observables on the tensor product Hilbert space. We need to change the structure of the quantities encoding evolution. Now they're Hamiltonians on the tensor product. And that most quantum of quantum mechanical phenomena has now made its entrance, entanglement. There is no clean separation in quantum mechanics between a system's degrees of freedom and those of its environment. If I want to understand how a system evolves under interaction with the environment, I have to know how to model the environment's degrees of freedom and dynamics. I can't black box it the way I can in classical mechanics. How do we then distinguish the Qs and the Ps in quantum mechanics and so define a free evolution? I claim we always do it in one of two ways. We just do it by fiat. Those are ostensibly, you know, those are the Qs, those are the Ps. Or else we introduce a representation of the Poincaré or the Galilean group, a la Wigner, and define Q as the generator of momentum translations, et cetera. In both cases, what we're doing is we're explicitly and by hand, we're reaching in to and hooking the dynamics up to the background space-time structure to get a principal distinction between configuration and momentum, and so define free and interacting. We don't get any of it from the dynamics alone, as we get all of it in classical mechanics. There is no intrinsic relationship between the structure of the dynamics in quantum mechanics and the background space-time geometry. So where does this leave us? I think there are three possible responses. One, we can modify quantum mechanics, or we can look for an interpretation that makes the difference between evolution and interaction clear, as in classical mechanics. And this is, in fact, I claim implicitly, what is in fact the most common approach in most popular interpretations. It's what's done in many worlds with preferred basis. It's what's done in Bohm. It's what's done in GRW. I'm not so sure about the information theoretic approaches. I just don't understand them well enough right now. And the structure is too different for me to really get a grip on. But some people I've talked to who know these things better than I do, like Jeff Boob, tells me that he thinks that they do not fall in this category. A second possibility is to reconceptualize interaction in quantum mechanics so as to accord with the facts that I've stated. The third possibility is to get rid of the distinction between evolution and interaction altogether and reconceptualize dynamics. One smells wrong to me. It doesn't take quantum mechanics seriously enough. It's trying to force quantum mechanics into a conceptual scheme that came out of classical mechanics and that actually lives in classical mechanics. It would be like Einstein picking a preferred frame rather than reconceiving simultaneity. And two may still be too conservative, given the experimental and mathematical facts. Two recalls just reconceptualize interaction and leave everything else alone. I'll briefly suggest some points of contact between my observations and arguments and some quantum frameworks that may be along the lines of three: get rid of interaction, evolution, and reconceive dynamics. So first is, I think that there may be some connection to indefinite causal orders a la Hardy's causaloid framework and Bruckner et al.'s process matrix formalism. And I have two conjectures along this line. One is that configuration and momentum are not naturally and univocally distinguished by the dynamics because different causal orders require different momentum operators to respect the different null cones. Second conjecture is that one way to interpret a process matrix is as fixing the p's and the q's in the output Hilbert space. I'd be very curious to hear people who actually know more about this stuff than I do, their reaction to that. The second possible point of contact is with Carlo's framework of relational quantum mechanics. In that framework, recall, properties of systems refer to interactions, not to systems implicator. You can only talk about properties when, in the ordinary way of speaking, we would say when they're interacting with some other system, which is, strictly speaking, doesn't quite make sense in the framework, but that's the ordinary way of thinking about it. And all evolution is relational, i.e. evolution is the same thing as interaction, which is what we see, which is, I claim, the natural way, that what the intrinsic structure of the dynamics in quantum mechanics is trying to tell us how to think about it. So I think that I would like to try and figure out whether this way of looking at it is a fruitful way to try to understand the conceptual structure of Carlo's framework. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric, for the nice talk. We do have time for a few questions. Just check. Yes, Carlo.
Eric, yes. I couldn't agree more with the third options of the interest of the third option, namely, sort of reduce evolution to interaction by evolution meaning going from one interaction to the other, instead of having evolution without interaction. I think this is you're capturing the core of relational quantum mechanics here somehow. Think in terms of transition amplitudes instead of continuous evolution, then a mysterious collapse of the wave function, or a mysterious Born rule, or a mysterious something. Just reduce to the. I'm confused about the first part and the second part of your talk. Maybe it's just some technical confusions of mine. You connect that strictly with distinction between the Q and the P, configuration space and the. This is certainly true in the sort of Newtonian, in the strict sense, the T minus V systems. But in physics courses, we learn about systems in which the thing is much more confused because the sort of the interaction changes what we mean by P. For instance, is a magnetic a particle in a magnetic field, or a rotator in which the phase space is defined, but the configuration space is tricky. I mean, are the two things really so strictly connected one to the other? The two things being. The distinction between Q and P being physical, which is the first point you made, and the distinction between free evolution interaction being physical, which is the second point you made. The second point is completely clear to me, it's super powerful and clear. The connection to the first, I don't see it clearly.
So, I think it is. I think there is a very strong connection. And in fact, your example is really grist for my mill. I obviously don't have time to go into it here, but it turns out, quite shockingly to my mind, that classical Maxwell theory has exactly the structure that I claim that the Newtonian
because electric field and magnetic field are different. No, but I was thinking of a particle in a magnetic field. When we say the momentum is V plus A, the momentum is not V.
Right.
That's what I was thinking.
So that again, I claim will still fit into the analysis I'm giving, as long as the particle is propagating against classical space-time background. By that I mean Newtonian space-time, not special relativity. And so long as the force is just treated as being governed by Newton's second law, then it all goes through exactly as I've said.
But is the force proportional to the velocity, which forces you to have
it doesn't matter.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to study the details.
Okay, there is one more question by Czaslaw, final one.
Thanks for the f- for the talk. You were very brief about this connection to indefinite causal order. Could you be more explicit? Can you go back to the... You even asked for a reaction, but it was too brief to build up an opinion about that.
No, I really wanted to talk more about it, but I realized while trying to prepare this talk, and I had 15 minutes, that I had to give so much background that I wouldn't have time to talk about this. So to my mind, what I find really interesting about these ideas is exactly the idea that quantum evolution takes place without a fixed relationship to a background, to the background space-time geometry. And that is exactly, I claim, what quantum mechanics itself, despite if you just look at the intrinsic structure of the dynamics alone, that's what quantum mechanics is trying to tell us, that's how we should think about it. I find that the clearest way of bringing that out is to contrast it with classical mechanics, where to my mind, really quite remarkably, this the intrinsic structure of the dynamics alone ties you in this very rigid, concrete way to the background space-time structure. And quantum mechanics says, no, I really have no idea about the background space-time structure. You have to tell me, you know, where the null cones are. You have to tell me what momentum is. And I'm perfectly fine from changing my mind about that because strictly speaking, I never made up my mind in the first place. It's only you who reaches in. You want to make up your mind. Quantum mechanics, I don't care. I don't have to make up my mind. And I'm speaking very figuratively, of course. But this is the way that I'm thinking about this is the way that I've been thinking about the process matrix formalism. I don't claim to be an expert. I've just been studying it for the past few months. So I very much would like to learn more about it. But it struck me as a very natural framework within which to try to develop these ideas further, precisely because it explicitly says quantum mechanics, you don't know anything about background space-time geometry.
Yeah. Thank you.